Hallo and welcome by the rest is Geschiedenis. Tom, that was my terrible Dutch. To welcome
that
you back
sound
from
Dutch?
No, that for sure it sounded very Dutch.
Yeah, for sure, but you know, the Netherlands.
Yeah,
you sound German.
Well, there are some people, Tom,
I know,
who would say of the Dutch, they're just basically the German Scots, aren't they? They're just northern. They're basically Germans with a speech impediment.
Is that Dominic?
And Dominic, Dykes. Is that not right?
I've been received such a wonderful welcome in the Netherlands.
Yeah,
and you know it's my favourite country. I'm not going to have them insulted.
Well, it's a nominative determinist trip, right?
Well, it was a trip to see basically the Vermeer show that's on at the Rijksmuseum.
Yeah,
and I took my mother for Mother's Day.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to do, Tom.
Thank you, Dominic. Thank
that's
you.
That's a genuinely really nice thing to do. I admire you.
So she'd never been to Amsterdam.
Wow.
And she's 90 this year.
Yeah.
And last year she suddenly announced she wanted to go to Venice, which she'd never been to. And then having been to Venice and obviously got a taste for historic, beautiful cities with canals.
Yeah.
She announced that she wanted to go to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And this was just when news of the Vermeer came out.
Yeah.
And so I rushed on to the Rijksmuseum website and snapped up two of the tickets before they all sold out. And it was really fantastic show, as you can imagine. Are you a fan of Vermeer?
I do. I quite like Vermeer. We're going in May, I think, for a weekend.
To the exhibition.
To the exhibition. And we're going to go to, they'll have moved the girl with the pearl earring back to The Hague. And we're going to go there as well to see that. So
okay.
That's nice. Yeah, I do like Vermeer. I mean, I actually much prefer sort of Low Countries art to the Italian art of the same period. Just because I get bored of all the Virgin Mary and stuff.
And all the nymphs.
And all that. So actually, yeah, I do like Vermeer.
So the weird thing was, I've been to the Rijksmuseum loads of times.
Mm-hmm.
And two of Vermeer's most famous, the two cityscapes that have survived. So the portrait of the little street and the view of Delft are both on display in the Rijksmuseum. So I've seen them lots of times. But you know how it is? When you see paintings you've already seen in an exhibition, it becomes more exciting because everyone's clustered around it.
Right. Yeah.
So normally you'd go, there may be two or three people looking at it, but this time there are about 40.
Wait for 40 minutes to get through the crowd.
But I had an inbuilt advantage because my mother was in a wheelchair.
Brilliant.
She can't really cope. She couldn't face going.
So you could push her through. Around. You could bulldoze.
So I was like a kind of triceratops smashing my way through the undergrowth of a Cretaceous forest.
And when people got in your way, you could...
Yeah, I could
you
elbow
could,
them
you could
away.
Shoot them looks like really aggrieved.
I know.
Ableism.
Exactly so. But I mentioned the two cityscapes because one of the things that I noticed that I'd never noticed before. So there are, for those who haven't seen it, it's a view of a very kind of nondescript, undramatic view of a street with a house and a courtyard and a side alley and another house and some buildings behind it. And that's basically all it is. And there's a woman with her back to us. There are two children playing on the street. And then there's another woman who is sitting down in a doorway. And I went up right up close to this woman and saw that she has no features. So her face is a hideous mass of flesh without any features at all.
So this is the little street.
The little street. So it reminded me of the Emperor Justinian.
Well, this is when he was a demon. So I'm looking at her and you're absolutely right. She has no eyes.
Nothing.
She's sitting darning or something in the doorway, isn't she?
And so I thought, you know, there's the making of a horror story there.
Yeah.
Vermeer is called the Sphinx of Delft.
That's an episode of Doctor Who, that, Tom. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
They get to Delft and everybody's face has been replaced by like a blur by the master.
It's kind of melting.
Yeah.
And maybe you could link it up with Justinian.
Absolutely.
You know, who the servant comes in and he turns around and his face is a blob of featureless flesh. I enjoyed that.
That's excellent.
And the other thing was the view of Delft, which in Proust's great novel, there's a novelist called Bergot who goes all the way to Delft to see this view. And he sees that on it, there's a kind of little patch of yellow brickwork that he'd never noticed before. And he's so overwhelmed by this that he collapses and dies. Which is very Proustian.
God, that didn't happen to you, thank goodness.
No, it didn't. But I, for the first time, I remember that and scoped it out.
Hold on, where is it? I'm looking at the painting. Where's the yellow brickwork?
It's on the right-hand side, kind of between the two gates. Can you see it?
Yeah.
So again, if listeners want to Google it, it's not entirely obvious because it's not actually yellow, really, is it? It's kind of more orangey.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
On Twitter, you know, is this the bit that Bergot looked at and was reassured? Yes. But of course, then I thought, how do we know? I mean, Bergot didn't really live, didn't exist. I mean, how do we know? But that's apparently true. That is the consensus among Proust scholars, is that there's that.
Okay.
And the other thing that was very interesting, I don't know if you've read a book called Vermeer's Hat by a scholar called Timothy Brook.
No.
Which is very off the moment. It's about basically about where all the stuff that appears in Vermeer's paintings come from. So the hat, obviously, but there are kind of chests and things that come from Goa or from Indonesia or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a kind of wonderful book to have read before going into the exhibition. It's really great. Anyway, so I loved that. And then having done the exhibition, then took my mother to see all the other highlights in the Rijksmuseum. So the Rembrandts and all those kind of thing. But inevitably, I accidentally walked into what is the most shocking room in any major art gallery in the world, which is the room with all the paintings of the Battle of Medway, the Dutch defeat of the English fleet.
I'm not familiar with that battle, Tom.
When they hauled off Charles II's flagship and the coat of arms is suspended above the doorway. Absolutely shocking. So I rushed my mother through that so that she wouldn't have to see it. So that was obviously a dark moment.
Yeah.
But then we went out, and I just want to give a shout out to Marco Casanar, who was a head curator at the Rijksmuseum. And the last time we went there, showed me and Sadie and the girls round. And then he saw that I was in Amsterdam again and came and showed me and my mother a fabulous tour around central Amsterdam. So thank you.
That's nice of him.
Thanks to him. It was really great.
How did you just did that, wangled that through tweeting? Excessive tweeting.
Yeah, through excessive tweeting.
Talking of excessive tweeting, I've got a message here from our producer, Theo, and he says, Dominic, please mention the birds chirping away in the background whenever feels most natural.
You are a master broadcaster.
So, yeah, I thought that was pretty natural.
Okay, so you've done that.
Yeah, I've done that now.
Okay.
So, Tom, you returned absolutely fired up with Dutchness.
Yes, I did.
That's right, isn't it?
I always do.
Yeah.
Can't we do some Dutch history?
There's been talk of it, Tom. There's definitely been talk of it.
So we can do that. We can.
We've advanced further down the road than we were this time last year.
Yes, I think
that's
we have.
That's fair to say, isn't it?
We have.
Because I think the path was very much smoothed by Simon Sharma, wasn't it?
Yes.
He really endeared himself to friends of the rest of his history with this excellent commentary on our White Rose podcast.
And indeed on the Maid of Holland, which he also liked.
Well, I wasn't so bothered about that because that's his kind of party pre with that, isn't he? I think it was the fact that he enjoyed the White Rose podcast that, he's a different man in my eyes now than he was.
So we'll ask him.
You can ask him.
Fingers crossed he'll do it.
Yeah.
But it's a great, so we could do the emergence of the Dutch Republic.
Yeah.
William the Silent.
Assassination
thereof. The Golden Age. The De Witts.
I don't know anything about the De Witts.
Or is it De Witt? De Witts. Okay. They're two brothers who basically ran the Dutch Republic, and then they fell and they got eaten.
Wow.
And there's a famous painting in the Rijksmuseum of them, their flayed bodies looking very white, hanging from a rope.
Like the ancestors of Ronald Reagan, Tom. But they ate each other, didn't they? That's the difference. The De Witts didn't eat each other.
No. These were the Orangists, so the supporters of the House of Orange. And they came and ate them.
Crikey.
So much for the Glorious Revolution.
Yeah. Golly. No, we should do. We'll definitely get around to doing this. We are being constantly pestered, aren't we, about... you sent me an email yesterday from... Now, I thought this was so indicative. It was a publicist at a publishing house, not unconnected with my own publishers, but they came to you, not to me, because they clearly thought you were more pliable.
I was more susceptible.
Yeah. And there was no way in a million years we would ever have the guest they suggested. It was pure science. It was unadulterated science, wasn't it?
I did say that.
Yeah. Shocking. It was really, really poor behavior from the Engman Publishing Department, trying sneaking science into our podcast in the back door.
But you weren't having any of that.
No, absolutely not. No way. Well, you did the right thing in forwarding it. Now, talking of people harassing, some people might say, out of the blue. You have been engaging with a fan of the rest of history, haven't you? Because you've been watching the TV series The Bear.
last night.
Yeah.
So I came back yesterday and Eliza was going on about how she'd seen it, my younger daughter. She'd seen the show The Bear and it was great and we had to watch it. And I remembered that one of the actors in The Bear had said that the rest of history was something she was particularly listening to.
So The Bear, for the people who don't know, it's set in, is it set in Chicago? I can't remember.
Set in Chicago, yeah.
Chicago. And it's about a guy who, he's a brilliantly talented kind of Michelin star winning cook. And he basically inherits this, do you call himself a chef?
Yeah, he calls everybody chef. He goes, potato, chef.
That's right. I like the thing where they...
More parmesan, chef.
Someone is moving behind you in the kitchen. They shout, behind.
Behind, chef.
Yeah. I said, I'm trying to institute that in the Sandbrook kitchen. Anyway, listen, he inherits this diner.
Because his brother's killed himself.
Yeah. And he has to try and make a success of it as a sort of last tribute to his brother and to his family heritage. And they basically make, is it beef sandwiches or something?
Yeah.
That's basically it, isn't it? Yeah. But it's very well done. It's brilliantly acted, shot, all that stuff. And as you said, one of the stars.
The breakout star, Ayo Edebiyi.
Yeah.
Is she plays this wannabe chef called Sydney.
Yeah.
She's great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I watched a couple of episodes and then messaged her to say how much I'd enjoyed them. And she bless her, replied.
Did she reply? She said,
yeah.
You didn't tell me that she'd replied.
I sent you the reply.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, this is very exciting.
Did I not? Oh, maybe
no,
I didn't.
All I can see is... Oh, no. All I can see is you.
Okay.
It's your message.
No, okay, all right. No, I meant to send you her reply in which she'd enjoyed the Reagan episode.
Really?
Yeah.
That's my episode, Tom.
I know.
I should be.
That's why I sent it to you.
Well, you didn't, though. That's the key thing.
I mustn't be sharing private messages. But no, she said how much she'd enjoyed. She'd been listening to the Reagan episode and how much she'd enjoyed everything that you had.
I bet she enjoyed your impersonation.
She didn't mention that.
Do you think you might get a cameo on The Bear?
Well, because she's a comic as well as an actress.
Right.
So I'm sure she appreciated the comic.
Yeah, the comic elements. Maybe we'll be on The Bear. Maybe her character will be listening to The Rest is History in the next series, because I know they're going to do a second series.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Weave that in.
Yes, that would be a one in the eye for Ben Whishaw. Of course.
It would. Yeah, I think you could maybe leverage this to reignite that career that never was.
That's absolutely, yeah. I could be like a British restaurant critic visiting Chicago who dines there on that.
And how would you put Paddington in? Yeah. Paddington's your sidekick.
Yes, exactly.
Marmalade sandwiches, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, talking of America.
Yeah.
The American Revolution for a British Audience is the headline that Theo has given us for this. And this is from Scott Kay, who is listening to American History Teleseries on the American Revolution, which is based on Russell Shorter's Revolution Song. Episode 2 is all about Lord George Germain, how he was kind of a douchebag and running a multi-front war.
A
douchebag, I believe, is the technical term. And running a multi-front war from across the Atlantic, something which I knew virtually nothing about. I know all about the generals that are on the continent, but we aren't taught at all about the guy running the war from England. At any rate, I'm now even more looking forward to the coming series on the American Revolution from the British perspective. I hope you'll have a lot of detail on this, Tom and Dominic, for your US fans.
Okay, that was a very long message, Tom.
It was a message, long message, wasn't it?
So, this is coming in July. I was only corresponding with guest, Professor Adam Smith, this week about something else.
So he's still on for it?
He's very much looking forward to doing it. He teaches it at Oxford. Here's the thing, Scott Kay. This is such a black hole in Britain, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know anybody who has ever... Not only do I not know anybody who has ever studied it, I don't think I've ever met anybody who's ever read a book about it. It's just a sort of void. And sometimes people say, ah, ha, ha, well, that's because you lost. You know, you don't talk about it. But I don't think that's true at all. I think
it is a bit.
Do you? I think it would be obviously... Well...
Okay, so if you go into an American bookstore,
there are billions of books in the history section. Yeah,
there'll be shelf after shelf. You go into a British one, there might be one
maximum.
Yeah,
but here's the thing. I mean, obviously, the fact that it's not a war that Britain wins means, you know, it's not celebrated in statues.
In a sense, Britain does win because they're all British.
Yeah, it's a British Civil War, you could argue. I mean, maybe Adam would be making this argument in the...
So, George Washington, you know, a Great Britain. Yeah.
But here's the thing. I think there is only... We've talked about this before. I think there was only limited sort of imaginative space for things. And in the late 18th century, in Britain, the story is the French Revolution. Lots of people do that at school. And then they do Nelson. I mean, Nelson completely fills that space, which in America is filled by Washington or the Founding Fathers. That chronological space, isn't he? Nelson and Wellington. And the American Revolution doesn't quite fit in that story, because the story that we have of 18th century history in England is sort of, it's beef eating, Dr. Johnson, you know, the unwritten constitution, then French behaving badly, we go and smite them, and then we're top nation. That's the story that is sort of told.
Our perspective is a war with France.
Yeah.
So the Seven Years' War is a war with France. Napoleonic War is obviously a war with France. But to an extent, the American Revolution is also,
of course,
for us, about the war with France.
It is.
And it's about the French slying in, getting up to no good.
Yeah. In an internal domestic dispute that gets out of hand. That's, I think, how most people understand that story.
Yeah.
Don't they?
Basically. And I think that that's not an inaccurate perspective, because in the late 18th century context, it's the Anglo-French War that is much more significant.
Yeah. I mean, it would astound our American listeners, but they'll maybe say, oh, this is just sort of sour grapes or something. But I think to most people in Britain, the American War of Independence, as we call it, feels like a sort of sideshow. It's like a little appendix in between the big stories, which is the Seven Years' War and the French Revolutionary Wars, which of course last much longer, don't they? And involve a massive mobilization of resources, of kind of political, economic capital, all that sort of stuff, between, you know, the early 1790s and 1815, on a scale that is so much greater than the American Revolutionary War.
I definitely think, though, that it is because we lose. I absolutely because we've just been talking about the episode that we're going to be recording next week, which is four parts on the Hundred Years' War.
Oh, yeah.
So we're doing it on the 14th century conflict between England and France. And three of those episodes are about English victories. And the fourth episode, the first half, is going to be about English victories. And then the last half, which will be about 20 minutes, will sneak in the fact that we end up losing and get kicked out of France. We're very much as a patriotic podcast. We're not majoring on the fact that England does end up losing that section of the Hundred Years' War. And indeed, overall.
But as I said to you before, off air, Tom, I think if you go and you go and like you mess up a foreign country, and then eventually they kick you out, the pleasure is from the first bit. I mean, the point is the first bit, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, but it's certainly in England, Crecy, Poitiers, and Agincourt are a lot more better known than.
I don't actually know the names of any English defeats. Are there any?
Well, you'll find out.
That's so weird, isn't it? Because I know that we lost in the 15th century, but that bit, the Henry VI bit, is just told as a blur, isn't it? It happens kind of slightly off screen.
Well, it's Henry VI part one.
Yeah. Meanwhile, England had lost France. And it's sort of just, it's an aside.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's by and large, we don't tend to focus on things that don't cover us with glory, which I think is also why we tend not to focus on, say, Irish independence.
Well, we are going to do
something else that we're going to be doing.
It is. So yeah, we have lined up a very mighty series on paper, at least, about Irish independence. And of course, this will involve location recording, Tom.
Very exciting. Post offices.
Yeah, very, very excited. But we'll say more.
Bullet holes in Irish, in Dublin statues.
I believe are there not bullet holes in cricket bats? Very exciting. Well, we'll be revealing more about that later on. But just on the American-British theme, so Tom, have you been following Theo is desperate for us to talk about
Hugh Grant.
The dispute between Hugh Grant and his interviewer at the Oscars, which has been seen by lots of people as an absolute microcosm of English and American philosophers of life.
I haven't watched it because I've been too busy reading about the Hundred Years' War, but I did read about it. So I feel like I've watched it.
So he was quite...
But you've watched it.
Some people thought he was rude. Some people thought he was funny.
Well, can't he be both?
Well, he was both, obviously. I think he was quite rude, but I found that funny because I'm a rude person myself. it's precisely the course of... I mean, when I watched...
So, Dominic, when you end up on The Bear and your performance as a British restaurant critic, it's such a success.
At the Emmys.
You then get cast in a massive Hollywood blockbuster.
Yeah.
And you get invited to the Oscars.
Yeah.
you get stopped on the red carpet. It wasn't a red carpet this time, was it? It was a beige carpet.
Was it a beige carpet? Why wasn't it a red carpet?
Don't know. But I did keep on top of that. Anyway, so when you get stopped, would you be rude? Or would you apply your famous English charm?
Can you not do both again? Can you not be rude and charming? I think, because that's what Hugh Grant was sort of trying to do.
If Hugh Grant can't be simultaneous, I mean, was he rude and charming? I thought he wasn't charming.
Yes, I think he was. No, I thought he was funny. And I think he was there very much. He hates the Oscars, clearly. He's there. He hates everybody. He's famously actually misanthropic, isn't he, Hugh Grant? So when you, he played the sort of floppy haired romantic hero, but actually people say he's a very kind of gloomy.
So much more like his character in Paddington 2.
Yeah, he's very much like the character in Paddington 2. Well, no, I mean, he would have been my antagonist.
Could have been you.
Yeah. I mean, I could have played either of those parts, Tom, if I'm honest. Anyway, he...
Your range. Well, so you've seen it. Does it tell us profound things about the nature of Anglo-American?
Well, we talked about this a week ago, about the American tendency to inflate and the British to debunk.
To deflate.
To deflate. Yeah, the British instinct, particularly among British public schoolboys, is to be very cynical, to take the air out of everything, to find nothing cool, or to be enthusiastic about nothing, all of that, to make a joke of everything. And the thing about the Oscars is nobody really takes, everyone takes it very seriously, don't they? It's a wonderful evening. I'm so excited to be here. I can't wait. Cause she says to him at one point, is there anybody that you're really looking forward to winning? Are you hoping anybody wins? And he says, no, not really.
And didn't he make a joke about Bunyan and Vanity Fair?
Yeah, so she says to him, what do you make of the Oscars? And he reacts as though he's stunned to be asked that question, which I think is clearly very fine acting from Hugh Grant, because he must know by now that he's going to be asked that question. So she says, are you so exciting to be here? What do you make of it? And he says, oh gosh, well, and then he does this sort of routine of as though he's rummaging through his mind, trying to think of something
Boris
nice
Johnson
to say.
Does as well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Ironically, because Hugh Grant hates Boris Johnson, but there's a certain similarity there.
Exactly. So he does this sort of faux rummaging, and then he says, oh, well, all the world is here. It's Vanity Fair, or something like this. In other words, he's sending two messages. So to some people, he's sending a message, I'm very clever and I've made a reference that you don't get. And to others, he's saying, I can't think of anything nice to say about this ghastly business, and I'm mocking these Americans. And she then mistakes it for the Vanity Fair party and says, oh yeah, the Vanity Fair party. Isn't that great? And he does this sort of very, very, like this subtle eye roll. Now, a lot of people say it's very bad behavior. He's making fun of this poor woman who's a model and an interviewer. He should have played along. He shouldn't have. And other people say sometimes, there's a lot of pleasure to be got out of kicking people.
And that's where you would come in.
Well,
with your old world charm.
Yeah. The charm of Hernan Cortez.
General Cornwallis.
Yeah, exactly. It's the charm of Hernan Cortez greeting his hosts on the causeway into Mexico City. I think that's Hugh Grant's charm at that point.
But no, after this, we're going to do an episode on Benjamin Lay, the Quaker dwarf, activist, abolitionist, who kind of echoes a lot of in his relationship to the Bible.
Yeah.
He's very much in the line that produced John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, in which Vanity Fair appears. It's a kind of allegorical scene. So there's a little link there, which is nice, isn't it?
That's not a link I was expecting from Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant could not play Benjamin Lay, surely.
No. No, of course not. No, he's far too tall. And he's not a hunchback. Well, I suppose you can play a hunchback, can't
Benjamin
you?
Benjamin Lay.
Or you can't anymore, can you? You.
Brendan Fraser played a very fat man and he won an Oscar for it.
But I think, isn't there a kind of a move that, say, people without disabilities are now not allowed to play Richard III?
Correct.
Who also had a hunchback, according to Shakespeare.
So I think, Theo is sending us a message, give the role to a real hunchback. I don't know how many hunchback actors there are. But Peter Dinklage of Game of Thrones could play Benjamin Lay. He's not a hunchback, but he is a dwarf.
He'd be perfect for it.
But could he do the Colchester accent? Because his English accent in Game of Thrones was awful.
Yes, it was. I don't know.
Well,
Who knows?
We should add this to our roster of upcoming shows, Tom, along with the Blind Beak and the, the Vermeer.
If anyone from Netflix is listening.
Right. A couple of other things. So there was some discussion about, we've done Hugh Grant. I don't think we need to return to Grant. Badil. So talking about fans of The Rest Is History, or listeners at least, we've had the Lady from the Bear, and now we have former Fantasy Football League presenter turned writer, book critic, scourge of anti-Semitism and so on.
And also historian in that show with the other one, whose name has temporarily set my mind. No, before him. That's you, that
is. Rob Newman.
Rob Newman.
Is it Rob Newman? Yeah.
Yeah.
So David Badil, for our overseas listeners, he's best known as a comedian, but he's also a writer and does loads of other things. As Tom said, he used to do a sketch where they were playing history professors who just hated each other.
And they get ruder and ruder and ruder.
They get ruder and ruder. They were Richard Evans and Michael Burley or something. Anyway.
Yes.
Or, I don't know, Jeffrey Elton and, I don't know, AJP Taylor or whoever. I can't. Hugh Trevor Roper or whatever. He gave an interview to The Guardian of the week about, he's got a new book called The God Desire, which is a book about atheism. He mentions The Rest Is History. And Tom, his mention of The Rest Is History has left you very agitated, it's fair to say.
I am agitated because he said that we, and I'm guessing he meant probably me.
Yeah, because I didn't speak in that episode.
Had identified Voltaire as an atheist, and Voltaire wasn't an atheist.
Yeah.
He was a deist.
Well, he says that in the context because he says, in The Rest Is History, they were talking about Voltaire as the first atheist. I thought, oh gosh, I need to read up on this. I didn't know it, but I can't be bothered. And when you read this, you were terrified, weren't you, that people...
Well, I was agitated. Had I actually said that?
Well, I don't think you did.
I didn't remember saying that. I think that I had said that about the Marquis de Sade.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because the Marquis de Sade is an atheist.
Joining us on the podcast very soon.
Yes, he is. And the thing that's frightening about Sade's books is that he does push the implications of atheism to a kind of terrifying logical endpoint.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm hoping that that's what I said. Diderot was an atheist as well.
Yeah.
But less frightening.
So, Tom, what do you make of this as somebody who's written about religion? Some of our club members, Johnny G and Connor, gave David Badil a kicking because he said he couldn't be bothered to read Aquinas, Kant, and so on. It was late night, sixth form dead ends and pointless. It's the kind of thing I would say, Tom, but would you say it? That's the question.
Would I say what?
Reading, I don't know, Aquinas, Kant, and all these characters for a book about atheism. Because he basically says, I haven't done any homework, I've just written my book.
There was a notorious review of The God Delusion.
Oh, yes.
Dawkins' book by Terry Eagleton
in
the London Review of Books, where he said that it's like reading a book on ornithology by someone who has half read The Guide to British Birds or something.
I remember that, actually.
So, I think that there is a kind of assumption among atheists that everything about religion is so stupid that even to read about it would somehow taint you.
Oh, right, yes.
The people who believe in God are so obviously stupid and dumb that you don't even need to engage with what they write about.
Yeah.
And it's something that I have absolutely noticed, that people who are very, very smart, very well educated, who would be embarrassed to admit, for instance, that they don't know about science, Dominic, are not only happy to admit that they have, say, haven't read the Bible or haven't read theologians or whatever, or philosophers of religion, but are proud not to have done. And that it serves as a mark of intelligence that you haven't actually read any of this stuff.
Right.
Which was absolutely part of the anxiety that my editor had about publicising Dominion. And it's why there's no mention, no reference to Christianity at all on the British cover.
There
is
in America, right?
There is in America. So it's different in America. But here in Britain, I think that's definitely the case. And to a degree, I think in France as well, where it's kind of a very, very polarising thing.
Right.
And atheism is associated with republicanism.
Yeah, because sometimes people say to me who don't know you, a guy who was very senior at the Times said to me some weeks ago how much he liked our podcast. And then he said, now, Tom Holland, he seems a good chap, but is he, am I right in thinking he's a Christian? And he said it in such a way that was
sense,
like,
we all are.
It was a bit like saying, am I right in thinking he collects manhole covers in his spare time? Or, you know, like slightly infradig eccentricity. Okay.
Well, but I mean, with David Badil, he's Jewish. So his other, you know, the other book he's published recently is complaining that racism towards Jews seems not to count. Jews don't count as the title of the book. And one of the things that I argued in Dominion is that atheism is a logical endpoint of Christianity, because you can see that strain of the desire to banish superstition and to overthrow idols is part of a continuum that reaches back through the Enlightenment, through the Reformation, through to missionaries going and kind of chopping down trees that are sacred to Thor and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, it does go back to the Hebrew prophets. So it goes back to what Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Tanakh. And the hostility that people like Isaiah, prophets, have towards the idols of Babylon and Egypt. So David Baddiel as a Jew is as much an heir to that inheritance as Richard Dawkins, who comes from a Christian tradition, is. So I think you can have Jewish atheists and Christian atheists, and they both bear witness to the cultural influence on them of the Hebrew scriptures.
So
would be my argument on that.
We've just been watching the first series of His Dark Materials, the BBC adaptation of the Philip Pullman books. And I was reminded watching it, because I had read them years and years ago, and I was reminded watching it just how, you know, Philip Pullman is your classic kind of have your cake and eat it person, isn't he? Because his books are, they're sort of pure anti-Catholicism, aren't they? Don't you think?
The magisterium. It's absolutely.
But his works betray such a religious sensibility.
It's all Milton and Blake and all that kind of Puritan tradition.
Yeah.
And he like so much of atheist discourse is so Protestant.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially it's anti-popery without God. The hostility to superstition, the hostility to idolatry has become so intense that they've actually got rid of every, you know, of any hint of the divine, but it still remains in its essentials, in its bones, in its marrows, deeply, deeply Protestant.
Yeah.
Which is why it's ironic that Philip Pullman ended up being being nobbled by the contemporary equivalent of the magisterium. So,
what's happened to him? He's been cancelled about something.
He did get, because he, I think he stood up for
Cate Clanchy. That's
Cate Clanchy.
Yeah,
it's Protestants cancelling each other, Puritans cancelling each other.
Yeah, well, that's going back to your brilliant episode about Michael Servetus and Calvin.
Yes,
I mean that's kind of implicit in Protestantism. Now, talking about being cancelled, we've been cancelled, Tom. As often happens, by associate of the show, frenemy of the show, I think it's fair to say, Capel Loft. Do you want to read out Capel Loft's message?
Okay, so Capel Loft, for people who don't, who never listened to the episode that we did, the bonus episode we did where he came on, we did a couple of episodes, didn't we, on the trial and execution of Charles I?
Yeah.
Which Capel Loft said was, quote unquote, vile.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't he said he would unsubscribe to the podcast, throw stuff across the room. I mean, remember, he had form, because he'd previously tried to mount his own breakaway World Cup of Kings and Queens.
Yes, he was furious that our World Cup of Kings and Queens, there was no place for the King and Martyr, Charles I.
Yeah, so and he's no very Queen Anne, about that. Who's very King and Queen Anne.
He described Ted Valance, who was our guest, very distinguished historian
of the period,
but definitely a man, I would guess, inclined more towards the Republic than the monarchy as a hellhound.
Yeah, he did.
Anyway, so he reappeared commenting on the episode that we did with Peter Frankopan on climate apocalypse. The episodes on Reagan were great, but I have to be honest, Frankopan on climate change is so dull. It's not the rest is science. Had to switch off to prevent myself nodding off. Come on, Dominic, you can't approve of this dull science stuff. We want battles, elections, high politics, imperial daring do, narrative in general, not discussions of rainfall stats.
Yeah.
So, Dominic, a part of you must have some sympathy.
I didn't reply publicly, I'll put it that way.
Because there was quite a lot of science, although for my money, not perhaps quite enough science.
Not enough science?
Not enough science, because I did try to pin Peter down on exactly what it is that has changed over the past 10 years or so that now enables historians to have a better grasp of exactly how climate might have impacted different periods of history. And I wasn't entirely sure by the end of it exactly what they were. But
I think the issue with that is that when you're talking about climate in all world history, it's a subject so vast as to be unpinnable down.
But I think to the extent that anyone can pin it down, Peter does. I mean, it's an amazing achievement. The sheer, he literally begins with the origins of life on Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't cover that.
No, he didn't.
I knew that you'd start crying if I didn't hurl yourself out of the window.
Yeah, when I mentioned to him the Jeffrey Parker book, World Crisis, which is about the 17th century. And that takes, I don't know, 100 years or something. And it really goes into it in about 800 pages. And you can sort of see how the change in the weather works over a small period of time because it's really focused. When it's a massive baggy subject, I wonder how much, I mean, climate is obviously always a kind of a variable, as it were, but it's hard to tease out a single thesis that kind of sticks, isn't it?
But it's also the problem that the question which Peter is wrestling with throughout the whole book is the degree to which climate is impacting human affairs and the extent to which it's the expression of tensions within a political framework or whatever.
Right.
And has that, the extent to which that has been sharpened, so we can have a better sense of that over the past 10 years, I guess that that's how Peter is able to have written that book.
Yeah.
But I think I failed in exactly pinning down I put my hands up, that we didn't absolutely pin down what it was that has enabled Peter to have written the book.
You wanted more science.
I did really want more science.
I wanted less science. Yeah. I wanted less science.
I know
science.
You did. I know, which is why I was reluctant to continue pressing on that, because I was aware of you lurking.
You would have inflamed Loft much further because you wanted more rainfall statistics.
Yeah, I would very happily have done that.
Whereas I kind of wanted more humanity. So the stuff about Akkad, I wouldn't have loved, but I'd have mildly enjoyed hearing another, you know, having the Akkad story as the story. And then maybe in the second half, widening that out. But I don't think Akkad is just a tiny throwaway thing in his book, isn't it?
It's not a throwaway thing, but it's one detail. I mean, it is global history. He's the professor of global history. And so his range is absolutely prodigious. I mean, there's no one like him for sweeping from, I don't know, Tahiti to Peru to Canada. Yeah. I think that of all the episodes, it seems to have been the one that generated the most extreme opinions. Reactions. On either side. So Capital Loft hated it, but lots of others said it was, you know,
the best episode,
best guest, all that kind of thing. So Sophie Pottle, I found this episode informative and uplifting. If the Silk Roads ever get an episode, have Peter Franken back on, especially so he can take Tom Holland to task again.
Wow. Tom, it wasn't better. I'll put my cards on the table. It was not better than the Somerton Man. It was not better than the Danish Jews.
Okay. All right. Well,
everybody would agree with that. Right. Listen, Atlantis. Just a quick question on Atlantis, because Atlantis has only just come out. You've got both episodes. We haven't heard from Graham Hancock's solicitors yet, which is good. I believe I noticed there was a slight cut in episode one, which I was disappointed by because I thought it was funny, but there you go. I can't say it. James Watt the Sixth. Is the Atlantis myth and the conspiracy theory, Tom, and its resurgence part of the wave of resurgence in conspiracy theories that accompanied the scientific revolution? That's a really interesting question. It seems to James Watt that as the world has become less mysterious and more known, people have tried to replace the mysteries of faith, legend, and myth with conspiracy theories. Are conspiracy theories just the legends and myths of today? That's a fascinating question. Is there any truth in that, do you think?
So two things in that. I think that, so we talked about euhemerism, which was this idea proposed by a Greek thinker that the gods were divinized human kings, which was obviously a kind of proto-rationalist attempt to explain what otherwise might seem fantastical. And there's no question, I think, that over the course of the 18th and into the 19th and 20th centuries, as certainly in the Western world, there's a process of desacralization.
Yeah.
So there is an attempt to make sense of myths as the expressions of phenomena that could be explained in scientific terms.
Yeah.
But conversely, and actually you see this, I mean, this again is kind of part of what Peter was talking about in the climate apocalypse, the very word apocalypse. There's, I think, both among scientists, but also among historians, a nervousness about catastrophism, i.e. the idea that great upheavals can be explained with reference to volcanoes or dramatic changes in the climate or tsunamis or whatever. And I think that is obviously a matter of fashion as well as of evidence.
Right.
Historians who are enthusiasts for the notion of the longue durée, the idea that changes manifest themselves very, very gradually, very, very slowly, and that what seems to us dramatic episodes are merely surface froth.
Yeah.
are very, very hostile to the idea that things can be explained with reference to catastrophes.
Right. It's a bit like the arguments that we've talked about before about the Justinianic plague in the 6th century.
So that's an absolute classic.
Yeah.
That's an absolute classic example. And the arguments about whether the plague, the collapse of Roman and Persian power, the coming of Islam, all that kind of stuff can be explained in terms of climate change is, I mean, it's generated massive, massive debate. How bad the Justinianic plague was, likewise. And again, that's what I kind of wanted to pin down was, are we any nearer to a resolution to that?
Hmm. Yeah, that's probably a no.
Because so far as I can tell, the arguments seem pretty balanced on both sides, both among scientists and historians on that. I do think that one thing that has really changed the tone of the debate is basically the proof that the dinosaurs were wiped out by an asteroid. And that might seem a kind of a leap, but that was such a controversial theory.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, people, paleontologists' explanation for why the dinosaurs went extinct was much more gradualist. So that was going very much with the grain of scientific fashion and indeed historical fashion, which is to say that change is gradual process. The idea that the dinosaurs were wiped out in an afternoon, you know, maybe a year.
Yeah.
I mean, that's now pretty much accepted. And I'm sure that that must subliminally have a knock-on effect, even on historians.
Mm, interesting. But just on James's question, you've done a bit of a Frankopan and weaseled away from the question. So his question is
I haven't. I think I answered the question.
But his question is about our thirst for conspiracy theories generally and whether it's linked to the scientific revolution. Yeah. So in other words, as we became more secular and we started, I mean, whether we became more secular, we don't need to get into that now, Tom. But as we've retreated from the rituals of organized religion, have we become fixated on sort of semi-religious conspiracy theories like the Cathars, like the Templars, you know, the Illuminati, because they all, I mean, actually the stuff about the Illuminati is very Enlightenment. I mean, that's, or the Freemasons, they are Enlightenment organizations and the conspiracy theories about them are the products of the Enlightenment as well, aren't they? So do you think we are predisposed to conspiracy theories now in a way that we wouldn't have been if we were all very religious?
Well, I mean, the episodes we did on the Cathars suggest that the conspiracy theory was bred of the church's anxieties about heresy. So, no, I would say, you know, I mean, you know what I'm going to say.
Okay. Conspiracy theories are Christian, are essentially basically Christian. Is that what you're going to say?
I'm groping my way towards saying that. There was one other question which I saw on the Discord this morning.
Yeah.
Posed by the splendidly named Earth.
Earth.
As in planet.
Crikey. Okay.
Talking about the Atlantis myth and Plato's telling specifically, if this story is clearly a myth, why in the podcast did Tom say that Plato said that it was 100% true story in his writings? Well, because the reason I said that is that Plato does say that, or rather Socrates says that.
Right.
So that's a good question. So, I mean, Socrates does absolutely emphasize the fact that this is true. So what is going on there? I think that, so Plato as a philosopher is obsessed by the question of what is true.
Right.
And he, in his philosophy, the idea is that truth resides in a kind of dimension of the ideal, and that what happens on Earth is simply an inadequate ripple effect of that. So I think that is a joke about the inadequacy of history to rival philosophy as an explanation for what is true. I think that the counterpointing of the idea that it is simultaneously ridiculous, fantastical, not true, with the claim that it's true is a joke.
Okay.
And it's essentially Plato dissing the idea that history can ever claim to rival philosophy as a means for teaching truth. So essentially that's what Thucydides is arguing in his history of the Peloponnesian War. He says that, you know, the lessons that he's giving are not just of an age, but for all time.
Yeah.
In other words, they have a kind of universal application. And I think that Plato is essentially attacking that. That's what he's doing.
Okay.
Because the whole point about the Atlantis story is that it's obviously not true. That's the point of the joke.
Okay.
To people listening to it, they know it's not true. And so Socrates' claim that it is absolutely true is...
It's funny.
It's funny.
Okay. Right. On that Platonic, or indeed Socratic note, we should say thank you very much for listening. We have coming up... Well, you will already have... What will they already have, Tom?
They've got the two episodes on Atlantis.
They've got the two episodes on Atlantis. But is this going out...
This is going out tomorrow. We're recording this on Tuesday. It's going out tomorrow.
I've just lost track of time. So next week, we return with a diminutive story to start with. And then we have African Amazons, I believe, Tom.
We do. Yeah.
That's a very good episode, if I say so myself. It's a great guest. I'm sure that will go down very well. And then we're into the Hundred Years War. And we've been having immense fun discussing the titles of those episodes.
There is a Game of Thrones theme to them.
That'd be quite patriotic as well. Right, on that bombshell. Goodbye.
Goodbye.